apologetic look from the open pantry. Tea? He held up a packet of Tetleys, the box almost comically small in his huge hand. He was the picture of harmlessness. Joan stared at him warily. She still wasn't even sure why she'd let him in here after what had happened at the Waterman Stairs. He'd shown that he was dangerous, and yet... She remembered again his intensity of feeling when he'd asked her for the message. But he hadn't hurt her when he could have taken it by force. And then he'd saved them from the guards, and, more than any of that, she kept thinking about the way he'd said those words. The message was meant for me. "Why don't you turn me over to the guards?" she asked him. "It sounds like there's a reward." Tom put the tea on the table. "I would die before I'd help the court," he said flatly. Joan searched his face. He'd proved himself an outstanding liar, but she didn't think he was lying now. His mouth had twisted slightly as he'd said court, as if he hated the word. Joan ran her hand over her face. She had to think, but she was so tired. She was so bloody tired. She wanted to lie down right here in the kitchen and sleep for days. "I'll make tea," Tom said, "and we should eat as well." They really needed to talk, but Joan nodded. "All right. How do pork pies and marzipan sound?" Tom said. "Like heaven," Joan said seriously, and he nodded, seeming too tired or too tense to smile. Tom took the pies from his stolen purse. He opened and closed cupboards and drawers, pulling out plates. His bulky body seemed to fill the kitchen, but he moved with surprising nimbleness as he rinsed and filled the kettle. Joan put the marzipan lines onto a plate. They were just smashed paste now. She found some mugs for the tea. It didn't take long, and when she was finished, she leaned against the fridge door. She found herself unwilling to shift the mood back into something more dangerous again, but she knew that she had to. "Who was he?" she asked. Tom stilled, his broad back to her. Without the clattering of plates and cups, the room was suddenly very quiet. "Who was the prisoner in that cell?"
"I told you," Tom said. "The archive."
"Who was he to you?" Tom turned finally, but he didn't answer. He had a boxer's body with big arms and broad shoulders. He was intimidating, even when he was relaxed. "If he'd been at the palace, would you have brought him back to the rendezvous?" Joan asked.
"No,"
Tom said. That should have ended the conversation, but Joan was pretty sure she understood now. "That room he was in," she said. "The bucket. The mattress."
A muscle jumped in Tom's jaw. "I saw the room."
"He was a prisoner," Joan said. "But he left you a message. He knew you were coming." She was watching closely enough to see agony cross Tom's face, and then she knew for sure. She had felt it herself every moment since the massacre. The inability to save someone you loved. "You went there for him, didn't you?" she said. "You went there to rescue him."
"Yes."
Tom's shoulders rose unsteadily. He was trying to keep his composure. Joan knew that feeling too. She'd barely been keeping it together since her family had died. She took a deep breath. She felt in her pocket for the plastic square she'd found. She held it out to him. "You were right," she said. "It was under the desk." Tom grasped it at once, closing his fist over it, as though afraid she might take it back. "What do you think the message will be?" she asked him. "Do you think there'll be something about the Transformatio?"
"No,"
Tom said, almost gently.
"The Transformatio is a myth."
It was what he'd said at the rendezvous, but Joan was sure now he was telling the truth. She felt her stomach drop.
"Let's go into the sitting room," he said.
"The sitting room?"
We'll need some space to watch.
Aaron was asleep on the sofa. He looked deceptively angelic like this. His lashes were as long as a girl's.
Aaron, Joan said softly. She felt bad about waking him. None of them had slept much over the last few days. She touched his shoulder. He opened his eyes. He blinked and then gave her a heart-meltingly sweet smile.
Hi, he said.
Then he seemed to realize where he was. He grimaced. Oh, he sat up, running a hand through his hair. What time is it?
Still morning, Jane said. We need to talk. Tom...
She looked over at him. Tom was watching her, warily. Tom's been keeping some things from us.
What things? Ruth said.
She was standing in the bedroom doorway. She looked exhausted. Her face was grey.
Tom hesitated and then uncurled his fingers to reveal the little square of plastic.
What's that? Aaron said groggily. He started to frown. Where did you get that?
He seemed to recognize it.
That's illegal. That's incredibly far from its time.
I found it in the prison cell, Jen said. Tom thinks it's a message from the prisoner.
Aaron's eyes were narrowing. Joan could see him making connections. The change of plans at the rendezvous, the way Tom had been standing over Joan on the steps.
His name is Jamie Liu, Tom said. He's been a prisoner of the Monster Court for, well, I don't know how long, from his perspective. From mine, 3 years.
What exactly is going on? Ruth said, and she might have been tired, but her voice was sharp and suspicious. What do you know? She said to Tom.
I think you should play the message, Jen said to Tom.
Tom pushed the coffee table to one side and rolled up the rug. Joan could feel the tension in the room. Tom's size alone was part of it. His muscled bulk seemed to fill the whole space. He looked at the corners of the room, the placement of the sofa, as if assessing angles.
Stand back, he said.
He waited for them all to shuffle away. Then he put the plastic square at his feet. The square seemed to shimmer. A small chessboard appeared, floating in midair. It was the strange type of chess Joan had noticed in the Serpentine Inn, the kind with elephant and sailing ship pieces instead of bishops and rooks. For some reason, seeing the board made Tom's expression soften.
Just because you beat me that first time, he murmured.
It's a game, Ruth asked.
It's a password, Tom said.
One that only two people know.
He placed a white pawn and then a black one, and then kept going, alternating between white and black, his fingers moving with unhesitating confidence. The pieces clacked against the board just as though they were real. But Tom wasn't quite touching them, Joan saw, and when he tossed aside the first pawn, it vanished like a popped bubble. He was replaying a game, Joan thought, recalling every move without effort. Whoever had set this password had known he would. Joan thought about the drunk idiot he'd seemed to be just a few days ago. The real Tom Hathaway was turning out to be an entirely different person. Finally, the white king stood alone, surrounded by black. Tom moved a knight into checkmate. And then the board was gone. For a moment, a number floated in midair, 10. And when that was gone, Nick was in the room.
Run!
Joan shouted.
Tom's arm shot out, catching Joan as she tried to flee. It's okay, he steadied her.
It's him! Joan screamed at him. It's the hero!
He's not really here, Tom said. It's just a recording.
Nick didn't look like a recording. He looked as real as anything in the room. Joan's heart was pounding. Aaron had tried to run too. His back was pressed against the wall. Ruth was behind the pushed back sofa. Her eyes were huge, breath coming fast. Nick looked deceptively unthreatening.
He was sitting in a wooden chair. And now that Joan wasn't freaking out, she could see what Tom meant. Nick was young, 14 maybe, and he wasn't here in this house. He was in the kitchen of a different house. There was a microwave, a fridge. Movement in the kitchen became a man walking toward Nick. He was clearly a monster. Nick was wearing a t-shirt and black jeans, but the monster was dressed for a different century. He wore a suit and a top hat. He removed the hat now, revealing sleek black hair. He placed the hat carefully on the kitchen bench and stood in front of Nick's chair. Joan swallowed. "Run," she whispered to the man, even though it was pointless if this was only a recording. Without warning, the man slapped Nick hard across the face. Joan gasped. Nick lifted his head slowly. The slap had bloodied his mouth. Joan closed her eyes, not wanting to see what happened next. In a way, having her eyes closed was worse. She remembered how Nick had shoved the sword into Lucien, in and then out. She remembered how he'd hurled the blade into Edmund's chest. She remembered Lucien's blank face. She remembered Gran, lying dead on the sofa. There was another sharp crack. Joan's eyes flew open again. She'd expected to see the man dead, but he was still standing over Nick. And now there was more blood all over Nick's nose and mouth. "What is this?" Joan could hear the horror in her voice. It didn't make sense. It had taken Nick just seconds to kill Lucien. Expression cold, the man drove his fist into Nick's jaw. Nick rocked back, just taking it. His arms were bound to the armrests of the chair, Joan realized. The man struck him again, and now, finally, Nick reacted. "Please," he whispered. Blood was running down his chin, down his neck. His nose looked broken. "Please, no more, please."
"Stop," a woman's voice said. The scene froze, or at least Nick froze, mouth half open, pleading. The man wasn't frozen. He looked over his shoulder at someone out of frame.
"I can get him there," he said.
"No," the woman's voice said. "Start again." The scene vanished, leaving the sitting room empty. Joan stared at the space where Nick had been, sickened. After the massacre, she'd imagined hurting him for what he'd done to her family. But actually seeing him get hurt in front of her, hearing the crack of breaking bone, she wanted to throw up. A number floated in the air. 15. Nick was in the chair again, face uninjured. The monster stood over him. Joan could hardly breathe.
"Who shall I kill first?" the monster said to him. "You have so many siblings. Should I go youngest to oldest and kill your parents last? Or the other way around?"
"Leave them alone," Nick said.
The monster struck Nick's face, breaking his nose again. Joan flinched hard. A terrible dread began to fill her chest.
"Stop," the woman's voice said. "Start again."
The number 93 floated in the air.
"What is this?" Aaron said. "He's the hero. Why isn't he fighting back?"
Joan was beginning to understand, and it was more horrifying than she wanted to believe. When Nick appeared again, she crawled closer to him. This time, he was on his knees, shaking. The chair was on its side, rope still tied to his arms. Nick seemed to have escaped it, but he hadn't gone far. He was kneeling by a dark-haired woman and man on the floor. His parents, Joan guessed. They were dead. They had the same stillness that Lucien had had, that Gran had had. Where before Joan had tried to run, now she couldn't get close enough. Nick's expression was a mix of disbelief and devastation. Joan knew exactly how terrible that moment felt. At the sound of footsteps, Nick scrabbled up, grabbing for a knife on the kitchen bench.
"Now that's what I like to see," the monster said. Some initiative. Nick backed up, the knife shaking in his hand.
Throw the knife, Joan willed him, and then wondered at herself. Whose side was she on?
Look at you, the man said, sounding amused. Armed with a knife, and here I am, with only my bare hands.
He held them up in mockery, as though Nick were arresting him. He was still advancing.
But then I killed them with my bare hands, didn't I?
You just touched them, Nick said uncertainly. You touched their necks and they fell.
That's right, the man said, because I'm a monster.
A monster? Nick still sounded confused.
I stole your parents' time from them, the man said. All that they had left in them, just like I've stolen from thousands of people before them. Just like I'm going to steal your life from you.
You're not well, Nick said. The man was within arm's reach of Nick now, close enough for Nick to stab him. You're not a monster, Nick said in that serious way Joan was so familiar with. You're a human, and you're sick. You need help.
Stop, the woman's voice said.
Once again, Nick froze. And then Joan was sure. She breathed out slowly. The monster turned again to the woman out of frame.
With respect, must we use this boy? How many times have we killed his parents? He's always so virtuous afterward.
He spat the word virtuous as though it were a curse.
Perhaps a different human. This is the boy, the woman said. Not in spite of his virtuousness, but because of it. When we break him, that quality will turn into righteous fury. The glee in her voice made Joan want to scream. Now do it again.
210. Nick was in the chair, voice hoarse. You don't have to do this. You
stop. Again.
1100. There were more bodies on the kitchen floor. Joan couldn't bear to look at them this time.
You have so many siblings, the man had said to Nick.
Nick had talked about his family. He'd said that they'd all lived crowded together in a tiny flat. He'd never liked talking about himself, but he'd talked to Joan. And now Nick had his knife to the man's throat.
Why?
His voice sounded raw. He was sobbing.
Because I'm a monster, the man said. They weren't the first, and they won't be the last.
To Joan's shock, Nick shoved the knife into the monster's neck. As he fell, Nick's knees seemed to give way too. He made an agonized sound in the back of his throat that Joan would never forget as long as she lived.
No, the woman's voice said. Again.
1922. The kitchen was gone. Nick was standing on a street corner. He was far younger than he'd been in the other scenes. It was dusk, and the road was shiny with new rain. Cars flashed by, their lights briefly blinding. When the monster walked past, Joan almost didn't recognize him. He was in modern clothes this time, an ugly Christmas jumper and a blue anorak. Nick was fast, a striking snake. One moment the monster was walking by, the next he was kneeling, arms twisted up behind his back. Do you remember me? Nick said. This time his voice didn't shake. He was so young. Joan's heart wrenched for him. The man's laugh was brief. Nick snapped his neck. When Nick turned, his eyes were bright with triumph. A woman stepped into the frame. She was blonde and swan-necked, with the kind of face Joan had only ever seen on marble statues. Her imperious posture seemed out of place on that dreary London street. She belonged, Joan thought, on a throne. The woman spoke. The approval in her voice was at odds with her cruel, cold face. You're ready, she said to Nick.
You're perfect.
Joan's palms hurt. She was digging her nails into them. She'd drawn blood, she saw distantly. All the hero stories started the same way. Once upon a time, there was a boy who was born to kill monsters. But it hadn't been Nick's destiny at all. He hadn't been born into it. Someone had done this to him. Someone had made him into the hero.
She was the woman you saw in the hospital, wasn't she? She said to Ruth.
Yes, Ruth whispered.
Who is she? Joan said.
I don't know, Ruth said.
Joan looked at Tom and Aaron. Tom shook his head slightly. Aaron seemed dazed.
What we just saw, Aaron said. That shouldn't have been possible. You can't be in the same time twice. It's a fundamental law of time travel. You shouldn't be able to change the timeline like that. But they killed his family over and over.
And over and over and over, Ruth murmured.
It isn't possible, Aaron said.
How could it have been recorded? What family power can do that?
Nick had been tortured and then rebooted, so they could do it all to him again, over and over and over. He'd been remade. How many times had they killed his family? How many times before they'd broken him? That last number had been 1,922.
Joan couldn't stop shaking.
She rounded on Tom. Did you know about this? She demanded furiously, because if he had...
No,
Tom said. I had no idea that the hero was constructed.
You said this message was left for you. Left for you by...
Something that had been nagging at Joan surfaced.
Jamie Liu.
She paused. Aaron appeared beside her, footsteps silent in the carpet. Joan could see the wheels turning in his head, just like they were turning in hers.
Ying Liu has a son named Jamie, Joan said slowly. We saw his paintings in the Liu Gallery. They were all of the hero.
Tom's jaw worked. He couldn't seem to stand still. He shifted his weight, fists clenching and unclenching.
Jamie always loved the stories of the hero, he said. He was the foremost scholar of the myths.
Was?
He found out something he shouldn't have, Tom said. Something about the hero. Something he wasn't supposed to know. And the court just...
Tom swallowed.
Took him. They just took him. It was a long time before we were even able to discover that he was alive, that he was being kept by the court, that they were using him to keep their stupid records.
The Liu's had perfect memory, Joan remembered. She should have realized that the archive was a Liu.
We always knew that he was going to disappear, Tom said. It was in the Liu records. But I promised him I'd protect him. I told him I'd keep him safe. I told him I'd change the timeline somehow.
You've tried to rescue him before, Joan realized. You became a guard to get into the court.
I never saw him in the court, Tom said. I tried, but I never got as close as I did tonight.
Joan remembered what Aaron had told her once. Everyone goes up against the timeline. Everyone tries.
Jamie knows me, Tom said. He knows I won't stop until I get him back.
His voice cracked.
That fucking mattress was still warm.
As he spoke, the air in the sitting room seemed to shudder again suddenly. Joan shuddered with it.
Tom, she said.
She couldn't stand to see any more from the device.
Please, she thought.
But when the image resolved, it wasn't Nick. Tom stumbled closer. A man in his 20s was standing in the middle of the room. He had Chinese features and a gentle quality. The kind of person who'd help an old lady cross the street, Joan thought. Her next thought was that he looked ill. His face was gaunt, the skin under his eyes looked bruised.
Jamie,
Tom whispered. He lifted a hand to touch the man's face, but there was nothing to touch. His fingers went right through.
Hello, Tom, Jamie said.
He was in the prison cell. Joan could see the thin blanket, the cold stone floor. The sight of them gave her the swooping, sick feeling that she'd had when she'd been in there, the feeling from her old nightmares. She imagined she could smell the room again, fear and sickness and death. "The guards told me that no one would ever get into this room," Jamie said, "but I knew you would." His eyes crinkled, fond. "I love you." "I love you," Tom mouthed back, even though Jamie couldn't see it. Tom's expression was raw, an open wound. Joan felt like an intruder watching him. "Who'd have thought researching fairy tales would be so hazardous?" Jamie's chuckle turned into a pained hitch. He rubbed his chest absently as though his ribs hurt. The angle of his fingers looked wrong. They'd been broken and hadn't been set properly, Joan thought. Tom's own hands clenched into fists. "Tom," Jamie said seriously, "I found something I shouldn't have. The hero is real, and he's going to kill more people than you can imagine. He'll commit dozens and dozens of massacres by the time he's done. But what he doesn't know is what you just saw. That he was made into the hero. He was made into this." There were echoing footsteps suddenly, real enough that Joan and Ruth both turned to the kitchen. But the sound was coming from inside the recording. From the muffled quality, someone was approaching Jamie's room. "The woman who made him, who brought me here, she believes no one can stop her," Jamie said quickly. "But she's wrong. She thinks she made the hero perfectly." "She didn't. She made a mistake with him. He can be stopped."
"On your feet,"
a voice called through the door.
"She wants you in the chair again."
Fear passed over Jamie's face. He forced a smile over it when he looked back at the camera. "Tom, you need to stop looking for me," he said. "You need to turn your eyes to what's really important. The hero must be stopped." Tom shook his head. "No," he whispered. "Yes," Jamie said, just as if he'd heard Tom's voice. "You can. For me." His smile gentled into something real and soft. "You hate goodbyes, so I won't give you one," he said. Tom was still shaking his head. Jamie kept speaking. "As for me, Elu doesn't need goodbyes. I can see you perfectly, even now. I remember every moment that we were together. Every touch, every conversation we ever had. For me, you're always here." The recording ended. They sat there for a long while in silence, Aaron and Tom on the sofa, Ruth slumped in a chair. "What are we going to do?" Joan said finally.
"What can we do?" Aaron said. His voice sounded flat. "We should wait out the Patel hit and then just disappear. Live quiet, unrecorded lives. Pretend we never saw what we just saw." "You mean give up?" Ruth said.
"What choice do we have?" Aaron said. But it wasn't just their own families. It was all those other people who were going to be killed. Dozens and dozens of massacres, Jamie had said. It was the human time that Aaron and Joan had stolen to get here. It was Jamie Liu being kept in that cell. And it was Nick and his family. "In that message," Joan said, "Jamie said that Nick had been made wrong, that they'd made a mistake." "If it was something that could have helped us, he should have just told us what it was," Aaron said. "He's a Liu," Joan said. "He's the Royal Archive. He could have told us lots of things."
"And?"
Aaron said. "And the most important thing, the thing he chose to tell us, was that a mistake was made."
"Well, he didn't tell us enough," Aaron said, "and we can't exactly go and ask him for more information, can we?"
Joan looked at Tom. He'd realized it at the same moment she had. She could see it in the shadow of resignation that crossed his face. "Yes, we can," she said.
Chapter 21. Joan wanted to go immediately, but Tom refused. "We're not waking him at the crack of dawn," he said. That gave them a chance to get cleaned up, at least. Joan had a shower. There were clothes in the bedroom wardrobe in various sizes, some new with tags, some pre-worn and laundered. Who had this safe house been prepared for? Aaron had said that he'd learned of this place from his mother. How had she known about it? More questions. Joan sighed. She found a pair of jeans that fit and a t-shirt that said Crystal Palace FC. Aaron looked pained when she re-emerged. "A football t-shirt," he said. Joan was surprised to find herself smiling in response. Only a few days ago, she'd found his grumbling annoying. "It fits," she said. "Is it indicative of your own taste or the selection in there?" Aaron said. "Nope, don't tell me. I'm afraid to know." He headed to the bedroom with a mild air of doom. Ruth joined Joan. "What's the bet he'll come back out in those same clothes?" she said. She looked better, Joan thought. She'd had a nap and woken with more colour in her face. "How are you feeling?" Joan asked her. Ruth sighed. Her hair was flat where she'd been lying on it. "The hunt power still feels burned out of me," she said. She added, very soft, "Do you think it'll come back?" Joan reached up to fix Ruth's curls. She didn't know, but Ruth had burned herself out to save the rest of them. Ruth would have stayed there at the court as long as Joan had gotten out. Joan's throat felt tight at the thought. "You should stay here and rest." "I'd rather be busy." Ruth poked Joan's foot with hers and grinned when Joan protested. "Anyway, I think we should keep an eye on him." She looked over to the kitchen. Through the open doorway, Joan could see Tom sitting at the table with Frankie in his lap. Frankie looked sleepy. She'd eaten two of the pork pies. Tom stroked her head absently. He was staring at nothing much. "You don't trust him," Joan said. "I do. We saw him laid bare today." "No, I mean we should keep an eye on him for him," Ruth said. "When you speak to someone you love before they know you, well, it isn't easy." Joan looked at her. Did Ruth know that Joan had gone to see Gran? But Ruth's expression had turned inward.
"Everyone tries to change something," Aaron had said once.
"Did everyone try this too?" They headed out soon after that. Conrad had apparently assumed they'd gone to ground. The police blockades and the bridges were gone, and there were fewer guards around. Joan found herself walking with Tom. He'd scooped up Frankie and tucked her into his zipped jacket. She snored, squashed, faced against his shirt.
"I think you'll have to vouch for my cousin," Joan whispered to Tom. "Apparently, she's banned from the Liu houses."
Tom's eyebrows went up. "For what? Theft?"
When Joan nodded, he seemed more amused than concerned.
"I was banned from their houses for a while," he said.
There was a nostalgic smile in his voice. It seemed to be a good memory.
"Don't worry about it," he said. "You're all with me."
With all their precautions, it took a couple of hours to get to the Liu property. Tom guided them to a back entrance, a narrow alley between high brick walls. Joan was beginning to associate such places with monsters. There was a black lacquered door in one wall. A Chinese phoenix had been carved into the wood, its long tail sweeping almost to the ground. Tom's lighter mood from earlier had vanished. His huge frame was tight with tension. Still tucked in Tom's jacket, Frankie wriggled until Tom lifted her out. Once on the ground, she pawed eagerly at the door. When Tom didn't open it, she barked at him, sharp and impatient. Tom bent to stroke her brown and white back.
"I know," he murmured to her.
He straightened slowly.
"You know," he said, not looking at anyone, "Jamie might not be able to help us. He's younger here in 1993. He's barely even started this journey."
"He's already painting the hero," Joan said. "He's already interested in him. He might know something. Give us some clue.
Tom's jaw worked. For a moment, Joan thought he was going to refuse to open the door.
Frankie seemed to sense his reluctance. She jumped up, her paws against the door, and barked again, even more urgency in her squashed face.
Tom sighed. He fished a key from his pocket with the air of someone who had permission to come and go as he pleased. But his hand shook as he slotted the key into the lock and turned it. Joan wondered when he'd last used it. He pushed open the door.
Oh, Joan breathed. She'd seen the front of the Liu property, the gallery and courtyard, but she'd underestimated the size of the estate. Before them was a garden, artless and overgrown. The house had to be close, but by a trick of perspective, the greenery seemed endless. They could have been in the countryside. Wild crocuses and honeysuckle poked through the long grass. Joan closed her eyes and took a deep breath. Bees hummed. Somewhere, water was trickling. The air smelled of honey and sunshine.
Tom was a contrast to the serene garden. He shifted back and forth with the contained energy of a boxer.
Remember, he said, in this time, he hasn't been taken yet. He hasn't been forced to become the archive. He almost spat the word. He won't know that the hero is created by monsters. He won't even know that the hero is real yet. It will all just be stories to him. Fairy tales.
You don't have to do this, Aaron said.
Tom's jaw tightened. No shit.
He nodded toward the garden. He'll be down by the water. He loves the water.
Tom led them all along an overgrown path and down rocky steps to a burbling stream. It would have been the perfect place for a picnic, sunny with dappled shade from the oak trees above. By the stream, a boy of about 15 was sitting on a rock, his jeans rolled up, bare feet in the running water. He was painting fish in bold orange strokes that seemed to magically turn into living carp as his brush moved. Like his paintings in the gallery, this one seemed more alive than the world around him.
Tom held up his hand before anyone could speak. He stared at Jamie's back and swallowed.
Frankie didn't wait. She bounded down the hill into Jamie's lap, knocking the paintbrush from his hand. Hey! Jamie laughed as Frankie barked, delighted, licked his face, bounced away and barked again. Joan had never heard Frankie so vocal.
On the last bounce, Jamie caught her before she could tumble into the water.
Who are you? He said as Frankie wriggled in his grip, trying to lick his face again.
Hello, who are you?
Tom stood there, staring at them both. Joan couldn't imagine how he felt. If she hadn't known that this boy was the man from the message, she'd never have guessed. The man had been gaunt, every movement slow and pained. This boy was vibrant and full of vitality.
You okay? She asked Tom.
No, Tom said, but he made his way down the hill. Frankie barked at his approach. The boy turned. In his shoes, Joan would have jumped half a mile, but the boy's expression just turned polite.
Oh, hello.
He turned and saw the four of them.
Oh, wow.
He pulled his headphones off. Sorry, I had that blasting. The headphones were attached to what looked like a slim silver purse. There were little boxes scattered around, all with colourful album covers.
Music cassettes, Joan realised. The silver purse was a cassette player.
Are you Jamie? Tom said. His face was all cheerfulness as he introduced himself and the others. Joan remembered how it had felt when Gran had looked at her like a stranger. Tom showed no sign of what he must have been feeling. Your dad said you might be down here.
Does he need help in the gallery?
Jamie went to stand, but Tom shook his head.
No, actually. We need your help.
We heard you'd done some research on the hero stories. Jamie seemed puzzled. Frankie was finally settling down. Jamie stroked her head. You've come way too early. I've only just started researching them. So, maybe go forward 5 years or so? He suggested. I'll know everything by then.
Tom's throat worked. Sure, he said. But we'd love to chat now, too. Because, see, we're...
His amazing composure seemed to fail him.
Joan slid in before Tom's hesitation could get too weird.
We're collectors. We want to buy a painting, she said, from the Hero series. Your dad said you could tell us about it. Right, Tom?
Tom shot her a look of mixed thanks and disapproval. Right.
So Tom lied to everyone except Jamie. Noted.
Really? I've never sold anything before.
Jamie looked so happy that Joan felt bad about the lie.
Well, she would have felt bad. From the expression on Tom's face, they were going to have to buy every Jamie Liu painting in the gallery.
I really like your ring, Jamie added to Tom.
Joan saw it then. Tom turned his head from Jamie's view just long enough for the mask to drop. He recovered quickly, turning back with a smile. Thanks. My husband designed it. Tom kicked off his shoes and sat, mirroring Jamie's posture. Tom's body was usually intimidating, muscles bulging from his shirt. But with Jamie Liu, he looked utterly unthreatening. He'd put himself down on an incline. It made him and Jamie almost the same height. Joan followed suit, peering at Tom's ring as she sat. She'd never really noticed it before. It was dark metal with a scarred finish. Now she saw what had caught Jamie's eye. Etched lines ran over and under the band, images of hounds and phoenixes. They had the same quality of vitality, of life, that Jamie's paintings did. The same quality as the tattoo on Tom's arm. Joan flattened her hands on the ground. The grass felt cool and dry.
We're really interested in the stories behind the paintings, she said to Jamie. We were all saying that we didn't remember the hero stories very well.
Oh, there are loads of them, Jamie said, face brightening with enthusiasm for the topic.
Can you tell us about them? Ruth said.
Oh, Jamie didn't seem to know where to start. Well, different families tell different stories. The Patel and Hunt stories are mostly adventures. The hero fights mythical beasts like krakens and giant serpents, that sort of thing. In their stories, he only starts fighting monsters like us later in life.
Huh, Joan said. Those were the stories that Gran had told her. Aren't these just the Hercules stories? She'd said to Gran once when she was about 7. She'd been snotty-nosed and precocious as a kid. Gran had just waved her hand.
Oh, those ancients, she'd said. Always stealing our myths.
Now Joan felt her eyes well up unexpectedly. She'd hardly been able to think of Gran since the massacre without remembering her terrible last moments. This was one of the first times she'd remembered Gran just being Gran.
The Tawali stories tend to be fables, you know, with lessons attached, Jamie continued. And the Oliver stories are mostly horror. I guess they enjoy terrifying their children before they fall asleep.
Aaron usually hated people talking about his family, but there was mild approval on his face at this.
God, the Olivers are weird, Joan thought.
We were trying to remember a particular one, she said, where the hero has a flaw.
A flaw? Jamie said. A weakness?
You mean like an Achilles heel? Jamie said.
Sorry, he doesn't die in any story I've read.
Waste of time, Aaron mouthed to Joan. Although, Jamie hesitated, there is one thing. It's not exactly a weakness, but it is a vulnerability, perhaps.
Aaron lifted his head.
What is it? Joan asked.
The Liu stories are romances, Jamie said. In our stories, the hero was once in love with a girl.
Aaron grimaced and dropped his head again, but Joan's stomach twisted.
A romance, she said. The hero stories aren't romances.
The Liu stories are, Jamie said. We love a tragic romance. At the word tragic,
The sick twist in Joan's stomach worsened. "Have you ever heard of the Zensha, the Lishu?" he said. "The true timeline," Joan said.
"Some families call it that," Jamie agreed.
"The Liu stories say that in the Zensha, the Lishu, the hero was an ordinary boy in love with a monster girl."
"A monster girl?" Joan echoed. The sick feeling was getting stronger.
"You know, the theory of the timeline," Jamie said, "that when we make changes, the timeline repairs itself. It returns to its natural shape."
"Yes," Joan whispered. She had a feeling that she didn't want to hear what was about to come next.
"The Liu's believe that our timeline still tries to return to its true shape, still yearns for the shape of the true timeline. We believe that if people belonged together in the true timeline, then our timeline tries to repair itself by bringing them together, over and over and over, until the rift is healed."
"Like soulmates," Tom said.
Jamie smiled at Tom.
"Yes, if you believe in fairy tales."
On the way back to the safe house, Tom was very quiet. Frankie hadn't wanted to leave the garden. She had lingered by Jamie's side and had whined miserably when she had realized they were leaving him behind. Joan was quiet too. The first time she'd gone to Holland House, it had felt like a compulsion. She'd seen the name on a signpost and she'd had to go there. She hadn't been able to think about anything else. And then she'd met Nick, and it had been like she'd already known him, like she knew him better than she knew herself.
"This doesn't help us kill him," Ruth said as they walked. "It doesn't help us stop him."
"I told you this would be a waste of time," Aaron said.
"Our timeline tries to repair itself by bringing them together," Jamie had said, "over and over and over until the rift is healed." Joan had been drawn to Holland House while Nick had been there. Nick had found her in 1993. They'd collided with each other at the Monster Court. She remembered how he'd touched her cheek, how he'd looked at her, what it had felt like when he'd kissed her. But if the timeline was trying to repair itself, it was doomed to failure. This was a rift that couldn't be healed. Nick had killed Joan's family. Nick had been conditioned to loathe monsters.
"So what now then?" Ruth said.
"Now, nothing," Aaron said. "Now we wait for the Patel power to wear off, and then we get out of this time and live our lives in hiding."
Joan pressed her fingernails into her palms, over the cuts already there. She let herself feel the bite of it. Gran had told her the truth that night. "Only you can stop the hero," she'd said. In a way, Joan had always known what she'd have to do. Back at the safe house, Tom went straight to the bedroom. He left the door open at Ruth's insistence.
"I'm fine," he said tiredly. "Well, no, I'm not. But I'm just going to sleep, that's all."
It didn't take long for the others to fall asleep, too. Ruth on the sofa, Aaron on the living room rug. They were all so tired. Joan was tired, too. But she found herself staring at the photos on the living room wall. The mother, the father, the little girl and the baby. Joan had loved her family so much. She hadn't understood how much until they had died. She closed her eyes. Bertie had been the same age as her, and the gentlest of all the family. He had hated arguments. When they'd been little, he'd always wanted to play games that they could all play. He never liked people to feel left out.
Uncle Gus had been the family fusspot.
"Be careful out there, my love," he'd say every time any of them left the house. He'd put vegetables in everything, even desserts. "You have to look after your health."
Aunt Ada had been the smartest of them, except for maybe Gran. She'd never made anyone feel stupid, though. She'd been kind. She'd been a good teacher. And Gran. Joan squeezed her eyes shut tighter, remembering again how Gran had struggled for breath that night.
"You want to kill me before I kill your family," Nick had said to Joan.
Joan didn't want to kill him at all.
She couldn't lie to herself anymore. She'd been in love with him from the moment she'd first seen him. She'd been in love with him before that, in a whole other timeline. "He's going to kill more people than you can imagine," Jamie had said. Joan stood a moment longer in the living room, looking at Ruth and Aaron. She could see Tom through the open bedroom door. Lying there like this, they all seemed as vulnerable as children. Joan slipped into the hallway. As she reached the front door, a sound behind her made her turn. It was Aaron. He closed the door to the living room softly. Even without sleep, he was angelically beautiful, almost too good-looking to be real. "Let me come with you," he whispered. "How did you know I was leaving?" Joan said. "I just knew." For a weak moment, Joan imagined saying, "Yes, please, come with me." He'd been with her all this time, but this was going to be dangerous, and she'd risked the others enough. He'd helped her so much already. "I have to go alone," she whispered. Aaron dipped his head slightly. "You know where to find him?" Joan nodded. "Where and when?" Outside, the sun was setting. Low angled light filtered in through the wavy glass by the front door. It made Aaron's hair gleam gold. "Joan," he said, "you need to know that if you undo the massacre—"
"He has to be stopped," Joan said. "Whether our families can be saved or not, he can't be allowed to slaughter people."
"I know." Aaron took a step closer, and then he was right there, in her space, filling her view completely. "I know."
"Aaron, listen to me, please.
If you actually manage to do this, if you stop him before he starts—"
"No, I—"
"Listen to me," Aaron said. "If you change the timeline, I won't know you anymore. It'll be like we never met."
"We'd meet," Joan promised. "I'd make sure we did."
"No." His tone was serious and urgent, with none of his usual undercurrent of irony. "Joan, if you somehow remember this, remember what I'm saying now. You have to stay far away from me and from my family. Never let me close enough to see the color of your eyes."
"What are you talking about?"
"My family can see the difference between monsters and humans," Aaron said. "But our power runs deeper than anyone knows. Some of us can tell family from family."
He'd just told her an Oliver secret, Joan realized. Aaron, who protected and defended his family always, he'd told her something no one outside his family was supposed to know. "Because you'll know I'm a Hunt," Joan whispered. "You'll hate me for it."
Aaron didn't answer, but Joan knew the truth. For monsters, blood didn't come into it. Family was power and power was family, and she didn't have the Hunt power.
"In a human sense, they're your family," Aaron said. "You love them, and they love you."
"I'm not a Hunt, am I?" Joan said. "As children, monsters can have more than one family power," Aaron said. "We can have powers from both sides of the family, powers that jump a generation. But as we get older, the only power that remains is the power of our true family. When our true power stabilizes, we undertake a trial to affirm which family we belong to."
"I never did that," Joan said.
"You're supposed to undertake the trial around the time you turn 12. Aaron said. "I was 9.
"9?
That seemed horrible to Joan. To have a panel say that you didn't belong to half your family anymore. What if you had brothers and sisters who manifested a different power? Did you all get separated? I was so proud of myself."
Aaron sounded contemptuous of his younger self.
"I'd manifested what we call the true Oliver power, the ability to differentiate family from family. It's rare among us. But after I did—"
Shadows flickered over Aaron's face as a car passed, its lights shining through the wavy glass.
"After I did, they took me into a room. There was a man in there with his hands bound in a cage with thick iron bars.
His breath shuddered in his throat. They shocked him with a cattle prod until he looked into my eyes. They told me that if I saw anyone like him again, I was to kill them, or inform the court if I couldn't do it myself. Joan flashed back to Edmund staring into her eyes before telling Lucien to kill her. Then she remembered how Aaron had stood between her and Edmund at Whitehall Palace, shielding her from Edmund's view. How Aaron had taken Edmund's abuse to keep Joan safe. "I never saw anyone like him again," Aaron said, "until I saw you in the maze, until I was close enough to see your eyes." "What am I?" Joan whispered. "I don't know," Aaron said. "All I know is that if you undo the massacre, you can't ever meet me. You can't ever trust me. I won't know. I won't remember what..." He cut himself off. Then he ground out. "I won't remember what you mean to me." Joan felt horribly close to tears suddenly. His gaze was slanted away from her. "Aaron." "No, don't," he said. "Please." "Aaron," she said. She touched his hand. He was always so warm. Then he did meet her eyes. There was such intensity in his face that, for a long moment, Joan thought he was about to kiss her. He took something from his pocket. Joan's eyes were blurring. It took her a few blinks to make out a small object, a brooch in the shape of a birdcage. The base of the cage was richly decorated with flowers. Inside, a brown bird sat on the perch, head raised as if in song. Aaron ran a finger down the edge of the brooch. Gentle, almost reverent, and then he gave it to Joan. "I found it in the bedroom wardrobe," he said. "It was my mother's."
"Your mother was here?" Joan whispered.
Aaron shook his head, but not in denial, as if he couldn't bear to talk about it. "Can you turn it over?" Joan did. The brooch had a brass back with a simple pin clasp. Two numbers had been hand engraved. The first crossed out, 100. The second was in a different hand, 50. "The Tawali family has the power to transfer time into objects," Aaron said. "Travel tokens, we call them. You can use this one to travel up to 50 years without taking time from anyone." "I know," he said before Joan could protest. "I know. Morally, it's the same as taking the life yourself, but it will feel different to travel this way. I promise." Joan didn't believe that. Stealing life was stealing life. But all she could think about was that this might be the last time she saw Aaron, whether she failed or succeeded. "When you're ready," Aaron said, "just think about the time you want to go to. Do you remember how it felt to jump?" Joan closed her eyes, trying to remember that feeling of yearning from the pit. She hadn't let herself feel it since that day.
"I've figured out where you're going, you know," Aaron whispered.
There was a shift in the air. Joan felt his hand brush against her cheek gently, just for a moment.
"You're going home," he said.
Home. It had been a long time since Joan had believed she could go home. But at the word from Aaron, she wanted it desperately. And this was the feeling of the jump, she remembered, this yearning feeling. Nothing happened, of course. The Patel power hadn't worn off yet. "I wish I didn't have to go," she said. Aaron didn't reply. Joan opened her eyes. She was still in the house, but it was subtly different. The pictures on the wall had changed. The wavy glass in the window was clear and flat. And Aaron was gone. Chapter 22. On the surface, Holland House seemed just the same. Tourists wandered the grounds eating ice creams and sausage baps,
Costumed guides chatted to tour groups about the gardens and the house, except that Joan didn't recognize any of the staff, and they all had a watchfulness about them, everyone from the ice cream seller to the guides. A watchfulness and a military bearing. Joan had guessed right. She knew Nick as well as she knew herself. According to Aaron, tourist sites were often traps for humans. After the massacre at Holland House, Nick had turned this tourist site into a trap for monsters. Anyone who came here with the intention of stealing time would be caught. In the front garden, Thomas the Peacock pecked furiously at Joan's shoes. "At least you haven't been replaced," Joan said to him. He cawed back at her in his harsh, dinosaur way. He was well-fed and in an unusually good mood, tail feathers relaxed. Nick was looking after the house, it seemed. A woman's voice sounded from the terrace, unexpectedly cheerful. "Joan!" Joan looked up. "Astrid," she said, surprised and relieved to see a familiar face. Astrid had been one of the other volunteers at the house. She was half Chinese, like Joan, and half Kenyan, tall and black, with the straight-backed posture of a ballet dancer. Astrid ran up to her. "What are you doing here? I thought you were only here for the school holidays." She threw her arms around Joan. How long did Astrid think she'd been gone? When was this? She hugged Astrid back. "I'm just visiting," she said. "What about you? I thought you..." She stopped as she felt Astrid's grip shift. She glimpsed a syringe. Joan tried to struggle free, but it was too late. A needle jabbed into her side like a bee sting, and then everything went black. Joan woke to pain. Her head ached. She blinked her eyes open. She was lying on her side on a stone floor. Her heart started to pound. The far wall was iron bars. She was in a prison cell, just like the one in her nightmares. No, not quite. That cell smelled of sickness and death. This one didn't smell of anything but clean stone. Joan shook her head, trying to clear the bleariness. She tried to orient herself. Beyond the iron bars, the corridor architraves had a familiar pattern. Fleur-de-lis. This was the basement of Holland House. When Joan had volunteered at the house, there had been staff rooms and kitchens down here. Now, someone had kitted out one of the staff rooms into a prison cell. Joan tried to reach up to touch her aching head and realized for the first time that her hands were cuffed together in front of her. Her heart stuttered with panic. She tried to wrench her hands apart. "Hello, Joan." Nick turned fast. It was Nick. Of course it was. He was standing in a corner of the cell, in a slouch that looked very close to relaxed. Only a slight tension in his shoulders betrayed that he was feeling anything more. "How's your head?" Nick asked. Joan didn't want to admit to any physical weaknesses. "Bit over the top, isn't it?" she said. "The whole dungeon thing." To her relief, her voice came out dry and calm.